morning. I'm convening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, February 6th. We're having an informational meeting on cryptocurrencies. And there is no other business on our agenda besides the informational meeting. So that's opened. Mr. Allenack, would you tee it up for us?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This morning, the presentation, we have a professor from Oregon and two professionals familiar with the technology to provide a kind of a 101 and answer some potential questions.
Thank you. Please come on up. And you can present your information in whichever order you have organized it. That's fine with us. You just need to state your name for the record when you start speaking for the first time.
Okay. For the record, I'm Stephen McKeon. I'm an associate professor of finance at the University of Oregon. Just move to our first slide. So we've got a quick background slide on each of us. So as I mentioned, I'm with the University of Oregon. I'm affiliated with a venture capital fund called Collaborative Fund that deploys capital into the blockchain and cryptocurrency space. So I've seen it from that angle. I was part of a software startup called Skyward that is Portland-based, that does commercial drone software. So I'm very familiar with the intersection of regulation and technology. And I've also been involved with a real estate development group called Skyworks, also based in Portland. And so it's helped me think about how traditional assets and ownership claims, so those assets are going to be recorded using these blockchain systems.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Alpin Sheth. So I recently completed my PhD at MIT, where I first learned about cryptocurrencies and the underlying technology. I'm currently a visiting professor at Portland State University. I'm involved with the business school's new programming and curricula related to blockchain and cryptocurrency. I have been working with two companies, two organizations. One is the World Bank, and more recently with a company called EtherRisk, which uses blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies to improve insurance and make it more affordable and more transparent. Lastly, I'm a blockchain advisor to several companies here listed. One is called Raincoat, which is an insurance company, and Agentic Group, which is a consulting organization.
For the record, my name is Matt Chirrut. I'm the co-founder and head of research for a research group called Smith & Crown. We've been active in this space for about 6 years. We just produce research all for free about this technology. We study kind of everything, global macroeconomic trends, what's going on under the hood in the technologies, and we have a specialization in kind of the economics of this technology and of cryptocurrencies. Headquartered in Oregon, up in Portland, and been here for a couple years now. Also a research fellow at Singapore Management University, very progressive university that started studying this stuff before many other groups did. And then we work on an informal basis with a variety of regulatory institutions to just provide information and analysis about the industry, provide data. We don't have a dog in the fight with this technology. We're not trying to promote anything, so we just want to provide as much information as possible. One of the formal roles that we have is with the Chamber of Digital Commerce and the Token Alliance, and we're just the chief research advisor for them.
Thank you.
So we have a short deck. We're going to keep it very high level. We're not going to get very technical, just kind of explaining, you know, at a very high level what the technology is, and we'll draw some analogies. An analogy that is often useful to start with is email, because it's something we're all familiar with. I don't know if you remember back to when you sent your first email, but for me, it was I was a senior in high school. It was about 1994 or 1995. But in fact, the first email was sent in 1971. All right, so the technology was around for decades before it captured sort of mass adoption. And by 1978, it was about 75% of the traffic on ARPANET, which was the predecessor to the internet. We're seeing a similar thing with blockchain, where to this point, it's required a decent degree of technical knowledge to interact with, much like email did in the early days. But as applications arrive that allow the general public to interact with blockchain, and cryptocurrencies in a way that doesn't require any technical knowledge. I believe that in 10 years or so from now, digital wallets will be as prolific as email addresses are today, right? So in the early 90s, it'd be very common to meet someone who didn't have an email address. Today, it's very rare to meet somebody who doesn't have an email address. We believe digital wallets, we don't know what they'll look like exactly. They may be integrated into browsers. They may be standalone. They may be part of an email client. But we think it'll be the way that, that assets and value are transferred digitally. So to draw some analogies, these are protocols. And what that means is they're a set of standards so that computers can exchange information. So HTTP is a very famous protocol for websites. So this is how content is transferred on the internet. So what, it's the reason that different browsers can look at the same website and it looks the same through different software interfaces. So this allowed content to really proliferate, and it impacted, of course, many business models, but one giant business model impacted was advertising. So if you look at the many of the largest companies like Google and Facebook, those are primarily advertising type business models. SMTP is another email, or is another protocol designed for email. Now, if you ask the average person to explain how does SMTP work, very few people could do that. And yet, we all use email virtually every day. And we believe that's the way blockchain is going to move as well, in the sense that we'll all use it, and we're not going to be required to know all the technical details underlying the interfaces. And so this, of course, created a digital wrapper for communications. And what's interesting is that it not only caused many of our communications to move to a digital format, it actually changed communications themselves. So before, we might write a letter or a postcard, or it would be rare to write a letter that was one sentence, right, or two sentences. But once these moved to digital formats, the nature of the messages changed, where the messages became much shorter, and the way we communicated changed. So when we look at blockchains, these are, again, the easiest analogy to draw is these are just protocols, all right? Kind of like HTTP or SMTP, they're creating a standard, but the big difference is that these are new rails for value as opposed to content or to for messages. And so the impact will be, we believe, widespread across many different segments of the economy, so payments. Cryptocurrencies are often associated with payments, but also things like insurance. We believe it will impact financial markets, and that many assets will be recorded and transferred using this technology. We believe it will impact supply chain in some non-financial contexts, and then finally personal data.
I'm going to talk just a couple minutes about why this technology is so disruptive. And we'll start with blockchain technology and then build on that to cryptocurrencies to understand how that's one particular application of it. And we'll start with just ledgers. Like, historically, ledgers and ledger technology have been very powerful at catalyzing a variety of new industries. And all ledgers do is they record like who owns what, who has paid what, and they're considered the canonical source. So if two people disagree, the ledger is what adjudicates or is the final arbiter of that. And some of the biggest innovations or developments there was all these things. Double entry bookkeeping was probably one of the most significant in the last 1,000 years. And then digital ledgers, which are pretty new historically, have been one of it's the biggest precursor and the foundation on which blockchain technology is really built. Currently, the way ledgers work and digital ledgers work is that one company owns it and protects it at all costs. So one company, and we can think about this with all the data hacks that we've been experiencing recently, that one company is responsible for storing and securing data about us, about the things we do on their platform, and it's on them to secure this as much as possible. They control this, they own it, and we kind of use it at their permission. And that relationship is mediated by legal contracts, rights of use, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, we really trust the institution or the entity to protect and secure the data because they technically, from a technical standpoint, can change it anytime that they want. And that's been the paradigm that has been with us for the past 40 years. Blockchain technology, what this enables us to do is to have multiple people store the same copy of a database with no one person having the ability to change anything in it. There's some applications of cryptography in there and economics that we won't bore you with unless you're really interested. But that's the piece that has proven so disruptive. Is there a paradigm of data storage that enables multiple people to store the same copy of the database, and we can all agree on what's true without trusting one group to secure it at all costs and to tell us what the state of the database is. And what's really important here is that it's very important, powerful, and has a number of implications, is that transactions that happen in this database are immutable, so they're not reversible in the way that they often are in centralized databases. With payments, with messages, with emails, those things can be changed retroactively. And in a blockchain context, they can't. Once it happens, there's a record of it forever. And if anyone tries to change it or tamper with it, it's really, really obvious. So where this comes in with payments and with money specifically is that when we send money and digital money today, there needs to be some entity that at a really, really high level, like, knows that my digital account on Wells Fargo, because we're not moving cash, my digital account on Wells Fargo goes down at the same rate a Citibank or an Umpqua bank record goes up. And in order to do that, we use what's called a clearinghouse. And this is true for any interbank transfers, because money today, so much of money today isn't in cash or in gold, but it's in entries in digital ledgers that different entities control. And to ensure that those all stay in sync, that none are going up or going down, we use intermediaries to help transfer those. And even at the level of peer-to-peer payments, so if I want to transfer money to Steve, because, you know, he picked up dinner, I would do that through a bank, I do it through PayPal, I do it through Venmo, and they're the entities that would ensure that the amount that I said that I would pay is the amount that actually gets credited to his account. And so using blockchain technology, we can do away with that centralized entity. So we can just use a Bitcoin blockchain or a variety of other blockchains to transfer value. And because the transactions are immutable, everyone can see them. And this combination of math and cryptography kind of ensures that the two, mine gets debited at the same rate that his gets credited. We can start transferring value in digital value in a way that doesn't rely on an intermediary. And that's the fundamental piece of innovation, why so many people are really building on this. And that can be true for supply chain data. So where a piece of goods originated and how it moves through a supply chain that could include 10 to 20 different suppliers, all with their own digital databases. It can be used for personal data, for medical records, for anything that involves a lot of different people managing or inputting data into one database. And currently in this, the way that data are currently organized, they all have to consistently sync between their different databases. And blockchain allows us to do that using just one database in a way that everyone theoretically trusts. So that's where this technology, that's why people are so interested in this technology, and that's its specific application in payments and in currencies.
I wanted to just address something that I think would be relevant as far as the state of Oregon, and that has to do with what are the implications for that more locally here. Well, the first is that, so as we've already heard, blockchain technology has received quite a bit of attention, and a lot of employers are very interested in developing capabilities or developing applications, developing use cases for this technology. And what we've seen already is that, for instance, LinkedIn does a survey and a report every year to show what kinds of jobs are being created and offered on their platform. And being that it's one of the largest, they were able to show that there was a significant increase in blockchain-related jobs, especially from the engineering perspective. And it was the fastest growing and the largest as far as emerging jobs in 2018 relative to other technical jobs that we see here listed here, like machine learning, application development, machine learning, things like that. The key takeaway from a percentage perspective was that they were able to show that the demand for developers that understand the technology grew by 3,300%, which was dramatic relative to a lot of the other technologies. And what I wanted to show here in the next slide is that the implications for Oregon are that we are seeing, given the fact that Oregon already has quite a bit of engineering talent, there are a lot of companies that are moving here or opening additional offices in Oregon in order to attract talent for this particular sector. So we have, as an example here, one of the largest, if not the largest, U.S. entity that uses cryptocurrency as the foundation of their business. It's called Coinbase, which opened an office in Portland last year and had a grand opening recently in the city. And this is a large company valued at around $8 billion. And they are essentially an exchange and a wallet service where people can hold digital currency like Bitcoin or Ether, or sometimes we can address it later on in the conversation, currencies that actually are pegged to the US dollar, for instance, called stable coins, and then offer a service for trading these currencies. As you can see in the slide, the actual downloads for this application exceed those of what we consider some of the most popular applications like Snapchat and Instagram. A lot of this is driven by particular demographics, but what we're seeing regardless is that there's a lot of interest in using these applications, so it makes sense to try to understand what is driving those trends, especially as they implicate Oregon and the job market here, given that a lot of people are looking for these types of jobs.
Excuse me, Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. Just so I can get a handle on it, I'm going to see if my mind is working correctly today. In the understanding of a blockchain, would it be similar to a platform like Dropbox, where there's multiple users sharing data? So if I drop a file into a folder, it appears not only on my phone, but on my assistant's phone and everybody else that has access to that. And so the file system, long as we're all synced, stays in tune with one another. In the same way, cryptocurrency or blockchain is the idea that if a transaction is made over here, because there are multiple copies all around, everything stays synced, so I can't maneuver and say, oh, really, I have this much value more than what you say, because everybody else is going to reconcile and say, no, you're tweaking the system. Or when I tweak it, a notice is made in the ledger to say, Reschke is gaming the system. Is that maybe crude, but is it close to where we're at here?
Sure. Actually, that's a really good analogy. Okay. I think that, Representative, I think the key here is that as far as having the same copy or the same version of that information is key here, and that if someone does tweak or try to game the system from their perspective, that others can actually see that has been, that transformation's made. The key differences from something like Dropbox, beyond the analogy, are just one, that the level of cryptography, so the security, is just much more advanced. That's one. And then the second has to do with the fact that the cryptocurrency and the blockchain sort of systems, they keep track of versions, but they also allow for other types of interaction. So you can have, essentially, when we think about things like new trends in automation, for instance, there are programs that can actually be put onto blockchain as well that can operate like this. And so that's not necessarily something you would put on block on Dropbox.
Right.
And the last piece is the difference between putting it on blockchain versus on one company's server.
Right.
So Dropbox is one server, or like it might be multiple servers, but it's one company.
One company. Right.
And that's basically a one of the distinctions, but exactly I think your analogy is right.
Okay, thank you.
And then just to add one more example, just to make it more concrete as to why it is that there's interest in this technology locally. So recently this partnership was announced between several different local employers, both in the in many different sectors and also involving the public sector as well, where several of these employers, including Nike, Intel, RGA, which is an agency, a public relations agency, OHSU, and then I have a Smith & Crown, which Math represents, essentially working together to consider how these technologies can be used in practice in very specific sectors. So, for instance, for securing patient medical records, in a secure way, but in a practical way in which it can actually be seen by the different providers that a single patient has and wants to give access to. Also making sure that the patient actually has ownership and protections around the relationship between that data and their own self, so that they have actually a more direct relationship to that data. We see companies like Nike looking at how to use this both blockchain and cryptocurrency in relation to their products as they track them from the creation of the product all the way to the consumer. And I can list more examples, but essentially each of these employers or companies are looking for how to use this in a practical way that will benefit consumers and, in some cases, patients and citizens. A key ingredient or a key component, I think, that would be relevant to regulators and to the government is that in a lot of these cases, we can actually provide real-time transparency that otherwise, you know, you would be able to get, but at a maybe delayed, like a time lag on a quarterly basis, on an annual basis. There's the possibility of providing more real-time information about how money is actually being transmitted and how this information is being used.
This is our sort of last example in terms of implications for Oregon. I just thought I would comment that the University of Oregon has actually received a very substantial gift from a cryptocurrency called Ripple, which is based out of the Bay Area. And that has funded primary research. It has funded a student group that is studying this technology and its implications and bringing speakers to campus. And so we're already seeing capital flow into the state of Oregon from that type of initiative. We thought we'd also address a couple potential concerns. Since this is the Revenue Committee, we assume you're particularly interested in tax. And of course, there has been headlines around tax evasion around cryptocurrencies. So there's a relatively famous case or situation involving the IRS and Coinbase. Coinbase is the company we mentioned earlier that's probably the largest U.S. exchange for these digital assets. And the IRS made a request to them because it's very difficult to regulate the technology itself. Bitcoin is really just a software program that's running on a bunch of computers all at the same time. But what you can regulate, or the place where you can potentially have some enforcement, are what we call the on and off ramps. So at some point, fiat currency, our dollars, has to get into the system to be able to buy these currencies, which then be traded against each other. Coinbase is an example of an on and off ramp, where I would say wire or deposit money into my account at Coinbase, like from my bank account, and then potentially buy currencies. And if I earned a gain, so if the price of Bitcoin went up, and I sold it, generating a taxable event, then I should pay capital gains tax on that. Now, there's many, many different currencies, and so what happens is that people don't end up just using one exchange. People that are active in this space end up using many, many different exchanges because different exchanges trade different assets. And so the IRS did get, they worked with Coinbase, and I believe they got all the records over a certain dollar threshold, which was $20,000 of activity. And I believe this was 2015 or 16. And so that's kind of where the federal agency is at, is they're trying to work with the exchanges where the fiat currency would move on and off this system. We think that, you know, while there may be some tax evasion, there's probably the better descriptor is tax underreporting, because it actually becomes quite complicated to track your basis in some of these things, because it's not all in dollars, right? You could be trading into Bitcoin and into Ether and into Ripple and Ripple for Ether. And like, we think that for a lot of people, it becomes very challenging. So Matt, I think you mentioned, you know, that if you work with Fidelity or a brokerage and you're trading stocks, that you have reporting features, right? And you don't necessarily have those in
I can talk a little bit about that. And I do want to capitalize on Steve's distinction that there's tax evasion, could it maybe two versions of this. One might be an attempt to hide income that one got through the traditional system, through an employer, through typical business revenue. And that's very difficult to do. At least technology doesn't really enable that, because this way to acquire something like Bitcoin is to go through one of these on-ramps. And they collect KYC data. They have information kind of on you. So you touch the official system where your money flows are tracked. So that's difficult to do. It probably is the case, and we know this anecdotally, it's very difficult to actually estimate at a large scale, is underreporting. So the way this is taxed is as if it's stocks, which is kind of a nightmare, because if you go and try to buy a cup of coffee with Bitcoin, you have to report it as if it were a stock trade. So you need to know where that Bitcoin came from, the cost basis for it, so what its value was when you got it, and then what its value was at the time you purchased it. And that has to be recorded. There's a form called an 8984, I think, that you file that tracks all of your trades. And the way that, so when people, and there are two big issues here. One is that usually when people do this, like if someone's doing trading stocks, a broker will just prepare that for you so they can go do that. No such system exists for cryptocurrency. You have to draw all of the data together by yourself. Using multiple exchanges, so multiple sources of data, which are completely unstructured or don't talk to each other very well, and do this. Huge shortage of accountants and tax accountants that can help people do this. So the by far and away, the story that we've heard on this underreporting issue is just that people are so bewildered and so overwhelmed by knowing how to structure all these data that they give up. The second is that in the in this big the bear market, so big decline in 2017, a lot of people made money through the huge bull market, what we now call the bubble, when Bitcoin rose. So every time they traded, they got all that value that increased from the first purchase to the second purchase was counted as income and should be reported as such. And so when tax time came around, so in April or in October, when the delayed payment, when the filing had to be due, all of that value had decreased by anywhere from 60 to 90%, and a lot of people just simply couldn't pay it. And the third issue that exacerbates a lot of this is so many people in this industry have zero experience trading stocks. So they don't know. We have high school students, we have college students who are using this, and even a lot of young professionals, because there's something that's so enticing about this frictionless ability to do this trading that formerly a stock trading system is completely inaccessible to them. So they have zero experience doing this, huge shortage of accountants. It's really, really difficult. So far and away, the underreporting, especially in the domestic US level, gets attributed to this massive, massive difficulty.
I'm gonna let you take a breath At least two of us have questions. I would like to ask the first. So what you're describing, for me, illustrates the problem of fairness. Some people are paying their taxes because transactions are occurring in a traditional and understood way, and other people are getting away without picking up their fair share.
Mm-hmm.
So that one part is the issue of fairness. Among the panel, you've used phrases such as disruptive technology and technology that changed communication, not just envelopes went from this size to that size, but changed the nature of communication itself. Just like transactions in a barter economy don't really go through the normal taxation and subsequent revenue stream, what do you think will happen if transactions in crypto grow? And here's why I'm asking. Oregon doesn't have a general sales tax like most other states do. But if people start paying in a way that's not recorded, there's probably a way where the economists will say, well, we can pick that up because if we pick it up in the way that a manufacturer is producing or what they're selling to the retail outlet, but we won't pick up the end user's purchase, for example. How have you envisioned this might grow as a percent of the economy that's not noticed and therefore not contributing to paying for generally what our citizens use? Is this is the benefits of being in a society, and we're paying for public safety and for the safety net and social services and so forth. How is that going to work?
Wait, take the first. Yeah, this is an excellent question, Madam Chair. I think that for now, the money flows into the system. So maybe I'll speak now about where we are now and then where we might be. And we're put on our forecast hats knowing that this technology is consistently beaten or proved any predictions wrong. Currently, to get money into the system, it does require going through these on-ramps. So once it gets in, it's trackable. We still have this underreporting issue. Absolutely, absolutely true. I think we would say most people aren't trying to evade taxes. Doesn't mean it's not fair, but I think it's probably the source of it. But the getting money into the system is trackable. And then once it transfers around, if you take it off of an exchange, it is frankly very difficult to do because you are pseudonymous once you're in the system. So it's not clear, you know, Wells Fargo knows which account is mine, but the only person that knows what account is on a blockchain is me. No one else can really tell that. So definitely a concern. Currently, the only businesses that are really accepting cryptocurrency, I think Overstock, Newegg, it's very, very few. And a big reason is just no one, especially from a business perspective, wants to touch this stuff. It's seen as insecure because there's a lot of misunderstanding around how to actually secure it. So it can be hacked at any time. It's a huge reporting issue. So a typical manufacturer isn't used to accepting payments in stocks where they have to track its value as it goes up and down. So at the moment, very little of an official economy, especially that would exist here, that involves businesses, touches crypto in any way, shape, or form. And even those that do, what are typically involved is a payment intermediary called a payment processor, which is also an official established business. That means they accept the cryptocurrency on the business's behalf, but then give the business fiat anyway. And so as a normal business, they report their revenue and they would still pay it. Like there's not really like a black market for payment processing. Going forward, so that's kind of, I think, where we are now, that from the official economy of people buying goods and services outside of what might be called stock trading is very, very small in the United States.
Although if all these great companies that are locating in Portland and in Oregon succeed and in perfecting and marketing the technologies and getting businesses much more comfortable with using it,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's the good news and the bad news. then all the businesses who aren't using it now will start using it because they have a way of feeling more secure and understanding how.
Absolutely. The infrastructure that a lot of people are building now is for securing a lot of these things, especially Alpen mentioned stable coins. So a big issue to pay in a very volatile currency. And that gets a little bit better if you have a currency that doesn't fluctuate in value, like day to day and hour to hour. But a lot of the companies like Circle or big banks or Coinbase do collect identifying information. And so there's just no way to hide it. Like they have it somewhere, they're audited like a licensed business, and there's no way to really hide that. And so if that ends up being like the layer on top where official people, businesses, individuals with no intent to really perform tax evasion, because it's a huge liability for them, there's a way to natively track who they are, what its value is at any point in time. And so looking forward in the future, that's what we see that being a much bigger, not just the fiat on-ramps, so not once it goes into the system, but that tracks it once it goes throughout the system. So a typical payment from like me to Steve would involve two accounts, both of which are associated with us as individuals, not just us as numbers in a system.
I would add that in time, as the reporting systems evolve, that this will actually be easier to track than many other forms of payment. So if you think about people paying in cash, mm-hmm. right, that's very difficult. It's unobservable in a sense, like unless the business chooses to report it. When payments happen on chain, we can see everything that's happening. We depending on what wallet it's coming from, we may not know the individual that's sending the payment in, but from a business standpoint, if they're accepting cryptocurrency, whether it's Bitcoin or a US dollar kind of stable coin, we actually would see all the inflows to that business. And there's an argument that actually regulators are going to love this technology in the long run because it's gonna provide far more transparency into value flows throughout the system.
Representative Reschke.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And it might be just a comment for the committee, and feel free to chime in. But to me, this is not a paradigm change. This is a paradigm explosion. Because we're used to looking at things as investment income or earned income or transactional income. And this transcends all those in different ways. It could be payment for services rendered. It could be a payment in lieu of a product. It could be done as an investment. And so we have to rethink how we're going to look at cryptocurrency completely different than the way we look at income today in our current system.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually want to follow up on your comment and the good representative's comment. And take off on the word regulator. When I came into the legislature 10 terms ago, I ran on the fact that there was too much government regulation, too much. And I got into this building and realized quite often that industry brings forward the regulation rather than having regulators put it upon them. And one of the things I might suggest to the three of you who are part of this growing, emerging opportunity, and for those folks who are listening out there, is to get ahead of the regulatory issue and bring us solutions. Bring the legislature, bring Congress solutions on how best to regulate this rather than having it regulated upon you by folks who may not thoroughly understand all of those implications. And so just an observation that I'd share.
Well, Representative, you have good foresight because you're about three slides ahead of us.
I'm good. Thank
you. We thought we'd actually just touch on one other concern that's often raised, maybe less relevant to the Revenue Committee, but point to the energy issue.
This has come up quite a bit. There's what's called mining, which is you use computers to help secure the network, and in exchange for using your computer in that way, you get minted or given new currencies that come into existence. And there is an infrastructure for reporting that. It's actually a little bit easier than on the consumer side. But there's a lot of that stuff that happens in Southwest Washington and in Oregon because electricity prices are so cheap. And so the DAOs has become a big piece where people tap into the hydro in order to run these what are called mining farms. And so this has been another big footprint in Oregon. It's usually raised a lot of concerns because of how much electricity it's actually drawing, not just here, but globally.
Could you just paraphrase for us? I attended a pub talk, pub chat, whatever it was called. I have a sense of what this is, but you're talking about massive use of computer, computing ability, right? And that's what's driving the need for energy.
Yes. Yeah. Excellent clarification.
One comment on mining. So sometimes an analogy that's used, many of you may have heard the phrase Bitcoin miners. The analogy I often like to use is that they're effectively accountants. So if you think of all these different computers having to keep a ledger, and as the ledger grows and grows and grows and more people are using the system, you sort of need more power to do the accounting. And that's an oversimplification, but that's kind of one way to think about the miners, is that they're maintaining the ledger the way an accountant would maintain a ledger, and they're being rewarded for doing so. But as the system grows, it does use more energy.
Absolutely.
Anything else? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd really belabor this unless there are particular questions on it. But we can talk about that. I guess two things that I would mention is that in the industry, people are working on this issue of how to develop these systems that are less energy hungry. So it doesn't have the energy footprint, you know, the size of small countries, which is what Bitcoin does. That's kind of one. And then the second is the energy issue we almost see as a bigger, and the industry broadly sees bigger in places where energy production is a lot less regulated. So drawing energy from hydro and a lot of other clean sources that really exist in Oregon isn't seen in the industry as a really big problem. It's more when it's co-located with coal plants or other environmentally damaging dams and things like that.
I would like you to help me get a sense of scale. Often when energy consumption is explained in some place where I am, and I'm not a member of a policy committee on energy, for example, but sometimes I hear things explained in, well, this produces enough energy to power one single family home or a town of 10,000. So help me understand, one person doing data mining, how much energy are they using? Is it more than just, it sounds like it's more than just adding a second refrigerator in your house. There's a lot of power being used. Help me get a sense of, does that mean 10,000 people are now using something equivalent to one laptop, or one person is needing to use enough computer use that it equals something that, well, I can't even imagine how much energy it is.
It's a, Madam Chair, it's an excellent question. I really wish I had numbers off the top of my head. Do either the two of you?
I mean, I don't have an explicit number, but I would say that your thinking is correct. That basically it's an accumulation of a number of computers, basically. So when you have a miner, a quote unquote a Bitcoin miner, someone that's using this computing power, what they're is they're using more and more powerful computer components, and sometimes an array of those. So they're using like many of those, like you would see in, for example, I'm sure people, I mean, this is an example on the slide deck. You see a photo of these stacked up, and in a way, it's not fundamentally different, you know, in structure to a server facility that Google, for instance, is about to open or has in Oregon as well. Essentially, it's just a lot of these computers that are running this software, and often they will use very powerful cards, like graphics cards and things like that, just to make those computations faster. So it's essentially just an accumulation of a lot of computers. But okay. I don't have the exact number for you.
We'd be happy to follow up with research if that would be valuable to provide something more than a back-of-the-envelope estimate.
Is probably another committee that's going to be more interested in it. I just am personally, and it's astonishing to think that a bunch of individuals can cumulatively, kind of accidentally, have an impact on a community. that is beyond traditional, for example, planning planning efforts, mm-hmm. where you plan the growth of a town and you plan the infrastructure and so forth, and this happens in an unplanned way, and all of a sudden you have a problem on the energy grid. Yes, Representative Smith, and then Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just on this thought, it's much more than just low-cost power as to why these companies are locating where they are. You've got location onto the grid, because when you're moving power, that yields additional expense. In addition to that, you're seeing them on the river, because these facilities need access to a tremendous amount of water for the cooling of their facilities. Mm-hmm. Now, the water is returned back in actually a much cleaner state than it's taken out, but nonetheless, that's an issue. Plus, they're trying to be located in areas where they have redundancy. And so they're strategic sites. And so why right now we're talking about Bitcoin, everyone needs to keep in mind, whether you're Facebook or Amazon or Google, or the list runs on and on, they're locating throughout the world in these locations. And effectively, they're becoming the new timber mills that we used to have. Kids now can come out of high school, go to community college for 9 weeks, and earn a $65,000 to $80,000 a year with benefits working in these facilities. And so there is a blessing, and there are challenges that come with them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question that I think there's an intersection between our committee and the use of electricity. As we consider climate change solutions, and as we consider methods of taxing carbon or different methods of collecting tax to incentivize clean energy, what value have you seen from the industries that are using this new technology in its idea of climate change, or if it sees itself as wanting to invest in clean energy, as finding renewable energy, do you see that's interconnected with the business plan or the values from this technology?
It's a great question, Representative. And, I can really speak to just one example I've heard of, which is that, I mean, what's interesting about Bitcoin mining is it's a way to turn energy into value, right? So whereas a Facebook data center or a Google data center is just processing something for their platform, if you're mining Bitcoin or mining one of these other cryptocurrencies, you're effectively converting energy into a resource that can be valued. In fact, some energy companies are partnering with miners to locate miners on site to use their excess energy, to essentially monetize their excess energy. Now, what's interesting is that my understanding is that the lowest cost energy that's ever been produced was actually a solar array in the Atacama Desert in Chile. And so one of the things that Bitcoin has done is created these economic incentives to race towards the lowest possible energy generation cost that humanity can come up with, because that's where the greatest rewards are, is wherever you can, because they can be anywhere, right? They can be located anywhere on the globe. And so an interesting kind of externality of this race for low-cost energies, it actually has pushed a lot of development towards renewable energy. And so we see that as a benefit. And the goal may not be to do it because it's renewable. The goal may be to do it because it's the lowest cost. But as it turns out, renewable happens to be among the lowest cost.
And the question of climate change does figure into businesses and entrepreneurs and even regulators who are interested in this technology, primarily because one of the key functions of the technology is accurate tracking of things that are done in a dispersed, geographically dispersed way. And for instance, carbon markets could be implemented using this technology across jurisdictions and traded, for instance, using the technology. And there are several companies that are working on systems like that. And just in the same register, when it comes to not just carbon, but the environmental footprint of anything, of any supply chain, we actually have very little data and information about the footprint of a lot of the products that we use, a lot of the services that we use. And one of the advantages of using something like a blockchain in a more systematic way is actually getting transparency, whether it's for a consumer, whether it's for the regulator, whether it's for a large company, about exactly what environmental implications and resources are being sort of interacted with throughout the process. So there's quite a bit of interest from the environmental perspective in the use of the technology as a mechanism for dealing with climate change, for instance, or environmental pollution. As far as the mining is considered, in a way, there's advances being made now where you could develop a more energy efficient approach to the generation of cryptocurrency. At the same time, some of the computing power needed or necessary for high-grade cryptography correlates to energy use in some way, or computational power in some way. So there's a bit of a trade-off that different systems are using.
That's a good question. Thank you, Chair. And then we have three more slides.
So I was struck when you talk about using energy, and I think that the massive energy that's being consumed, even if it's cheap hydro, is an issue, because the cheap hydro is tremendously important to us as we move forward. And so your comment that what you're doing is taking that energy and turning it into value, from the point of view of us in the public sector, the question is how do we get social or economic value out of that, and not just personal? How do we intersect that so it's not just personal value, but that for the consumption of very valuable energy, hydro in this case, how are we participating in that from a social and economic point of view? And so while Rep. Smith's suggestion, I think, of the industry coming forward with regulation is a really good one, my question to you is, what should we be doing as a state now to set us up so that we can intercept some of these processes and share in the value that you're creating?
And we're getting to that slide.
Yeah, so I'm going to move right forward.
Thank you.
I'm gonna, in the interest of time, because I know we don't have a ton of time left, I'm gonna mostly bypass this, but I will say that there is a variety of regulatory approaches. So the place where most regulatory bodies have been is in a wait and see and learning approach, putting together task force, becoming educated. It's from the SEC to the IRS, so everyone from the national level, state level, and various global entities have all been in a wait and see. And we see this largely with many emerging technologies. So I mentioned I was in the commercial drone software space before this. It was the same thing. The FAA and NASA, they took a wait and see approach initially. Eventually, they start to understand the technology. They start producing guidance. They might do some sandboxing, so create a place where entities can experiment. They might internalize it. There's various governments around the world. Dubai is one of the leaders, where Dubai is talking about bringing all government records online and on chain by, I believe it was, I don't remember the exact year, but it's a relatively short time period within the next few years. And then kind of finally is new legislation, where a gap has really been identified and some new legislation is needed, because perhaps there's a gray area within current legislation. And so those are kind of the approaches. You want to talk about the different segments of law?
Sure. So this is mostly based on precedent of what has been taking place over the last few years. So there are several intersections between this technology and various regulations, and one of the areas that have been at the forefront is securities related. The issuance of each of these currencies, like Bitcoin, for instance, once they get traded, or new coins that are fundraised, where people are investing in them, raise questions as to whether there's actual securities that are being traded. And so there's quite a bit of interest and guidance actually that's been provided from a securities perspective. We addressed a little bit the question around taxation, at least when it comes to exchanges and how there's on and off ramps for that value transfer and how taxation plays a role there. Another one is money transfer licenses. So who's licensed to actually transmit this type of currency or these cryptocurrencies? And a lot of that has become a function of whether those companies actually hold that currency in some kind of storage or have it somehow sitting in what's called custody of that company, and that those companies need to be licensed usually at the state level and then taxed appropriately. Then there's the governmental uses, which is what Steve just mentioned recently, and then overall data standards as to how this data is protected. For instance, if we're talking about patient records or other kinds of information like government records, if they're stored on such technology, how that information is stored so that it's consistent.
So to address Representative Smith's question earlier about sort of model legislation, there has been a group that's actually been working on this called the ULC, the Uniform Law Commission. And so this is a collective, I believe it's a volunteer group largely, of attorneys from throughout the country that try to get together to put together sensible model laws on many of these emerging technologies. So they're not exclusive to cryptocurrency. They've done similar things for drones. They've done similar things for lots of different emerging technologies. They have actually put together and approved a model set of laws that would guide a state as to how they might regulate different pieces of this ecosystem, right? So which sort of entities should have money transmitter licenses, for example, which shouldn't, right? Which how might you tax different types of organizations, right? So how do you tax miners? Like, is the Bitcoin that they're mining, is that revenue and that type of thing? When I reached out to Coin Center, so Coin Center is one of the leading kind of groups. It's a nonprofit group that studies regulation primarily at the national level. I reached out to them and I said, we're going to be speaking to the legislature in Oregon. Is there any guidance? This is what they pointed to as the model set of laws that they're encouraging states to look at. So this is our last slide, just to kind of frame, you know, where we're at in the context of other states. There are states that have sort of taken proactive steps to designate, you know, what will be regulated and what won't. Those are kind of listed in green. The big concern is around money transmission statutes, because this is really a gray area, right? So if you just have a software program that is a conduit for value, but you never really touch it, are you a money transmitter? And so that where people have come down on this, or at least the suggestion, is that no, only if you're taking custody of the assets. There are some other states that have taken the opposite approach. And so New York is often the one that's pointed to as an example. New York created something called the BitLicense, which is probably the most intensive and restrictive state regulation. I think Matt perhaps could speak to that, since Smith & Crown was previously based in New York.
Yeah, absolutely. The BitLicense was just a license for any entities operating in New York that did understand and was using blockchain technology, particularly taking custody or helping it move in some way, shape, or form. It was very early. I'm trying to remember the exact year it was introduced, 2015 or 2016, way ahead of where many other states were. It did lead to an exodus of a lot of companies elsewhere. And it was seen by many in the industry as just a little bit too much too early, even if many people want standards in some way, shape, or form. But the BitLicense, I think, has been the most intensive, I think is a good neutral word for it, the most intensive regulatory framework that we've seen at the state level with money transmission. But there have been some lighter touch efforts. Washington is kind of one of them.
And then Oregon sort of fits into this category, which is really the majority of states that, mm-hmm. that haven't sort of taken a strong position on money transmission statutes and how these things will be regulated. So I guess just as a final comment, we would encourage the adoption of a task force or some type of group that could look at, you know, these this ULC model law and determine whether that's the right approach for Oregon. Because mm-hmm. as I know from other, experiences with emerging technologies, often what the space wants is clarity. Right. So maybe not something that's really onerous that's going to actually drive companies from the state. But I know, like, when we first started Skyward, commercial drone operation in the U.S. was illegal. And it was very hard to raise money because everyone's worried about regulatory risk. And as soon as the FAA came out with Part 107, which set down, here are the rules under which you can operate commercial drones, the industry flourished, right? And more innovation was happening. Companies like Skyward were purchased by larger companies. It's part of Verizon now. And so the larger companies and the bigger players just aren't going to jump in until they have that type of regulatory clarity. So I guess that would be my final thought, but we're happy to take questions with the remaining time.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The data standard seems to be probably a big deal to me. I mean, I, if you have this many independent coins and common common share, the data standard seems like it's a pretty big hurdle. Is that an overreaction?
So the excellent question, Representative. Most of the activity around data standards is less to do with the currency, just in terms of how it's used in the industry. It's an excellent question, but how it's used in the industry, it's more the impacts of like GDPR and other reporting, securing of personal data, structuring of data, and how a blockchain could integrate with that in some way, shape, or form.
Thank you.
For any of you who are following the presentation that's been posted on OLIS, if you look ahead a couple of slides, for anyone who thinks this isn't really a thing yet, you've got a photograph of a Bitcoin ATM.
Oh, yes, we have some appendix slides here.
Yeah.
So this one is in Pioneer Place. this is another example of an on and off ramp, right? So it's a place where fiat can be converted into cryptocurrency.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you all for your presentation. This is my second presentation on Bitcoin and blockchain technology this week. And without casting any aspersion on the other one, this was much easier to follow. And maybe it's because they established my base by talking to me about it for an hour on Monday. But thank you. I cannot say enough how helpful that was in figuring out our mindset and getting us thinking about it the right way, the idea of the rails and the impact on the industry. And just policy-wise, I just pulled up the bill that we talked about it in the Rules Committee, which is specifically about having the state study and make recommendations about the use of blockchain technology by state agencies to administer public services. So clearly different from the figuring out what we should do about revenue and rulemaking, but there was a lot of conversation on in that other committee about this is kind of a technology that could really revolutionize how we provide all of our services. So I just wanted to throw that out for folks to consider as well, and your input on that. I'm warning you that you might get reached out to again as we develop if we work on that as well. So thank you.
Yeah, excellent. I may follow up really quick. Just note that the three of us are incredibly excited about this. We're happy to answer questions offline, online, outside of this context. And if there are bodies or aides that want additional questions or input, we'll make ourselves available.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Representative Marsh.
And I would just add an example of parallel thinking. We actually have a bill in Economic Development Committee that would establish a task force to look at blockchain, much like what you just described. So we'll have to sort of fiddle around and decide which approach is the best. But I think we're all thinking we need to understand this a whole lot better than we do now.
There was an article in the New Yorker magazine, a year or two ago, maybe, about E-Estonia. And I just looked up something that it is a web page where it explains Estonia is probably the only country in the world where 99% of the public services are available online 24/7. But also much of the private sector is available online. And they were a very early adopter of blockchain technology. But I also stumbled on a site that says Estonia is considering, maybe, I don't know if it's an old article or new, considering their own cryptocurrency.
There's actually a variety. So this is a maybe a bigger conversation on the concept of stable coins. So cryptocurrencies that would be pegged to a fiat currency and might even be issued by a nation state. Now, Estonia is going to have to discuss this with the EU in terms of whether that's going to work or not. But they're actually not the only ones. There's a list of probably at least a dozen nation states that are looking at issuing currency on chain.
So after the EU's done figuring out Brexit, then they can go to cryptocurrency. Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, what do you foresee are some of the challenges besides some of the tax questions? And you know, I imagine banks aren't really a fan of this. What are some larger macro challenges that you foresee in the future for this?
Yeah, so great question. It's a big question. I think that, you know, what we've seen with a lot, all emerging technologies is that often they may threaten incumbents, and incumbents can adapt to some degree, right? So they may threaten sort of like the deposit segment of a bank, but perhaps they facilitate new types of lending that the bank participates in, or or maybe the bank invests in some of the rising companies and protocols that are coming up. So it's public knowledge that the operator of the New York Stock Exchange took a position in Coinbase, right? Because they saw that as a potential threat to their business model. I wouldn't be surprised if banks are also co-investing alongside venture capitalists in some of the new technologies that are coming up to figure out how it might disrupt them and how they might be able to utilize it. So I think it will be an evolution of the financial system, and some incumbents will be disrupted and other incumbents will evolve to try to make use of it. We do think like a change and a compression in the cost of capital generally is one of the kind of major macro trends that's gonna come out of this technology as it integrates into lots of different segments of finance, whether that be asset-backed tokens, so kind of like a share of stock or a bond on chain, whether it be consumer lending facilities that are kind of done algorithmically with smart contracts. And I know we didn't get into a lot of those details, but we do think there's a lot of changes ahead, particularly within finance, but within, I guess, many segments where data is recorded.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much. Great presentation. We're adjourned.